Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC Studios, I'm Brian Lehrer. This is my Daily Politics Podcast. It's Thursday, April 13th. The latest mass shootings, the one at the bank in Louisville that left five people dead and eight others injured, and the one at a school in Nashville that killed six, seem to be leading to at least a little gun law reform. You know, we always talk about the gridlock. Maybe there's a little crack in the gridlock after these two. We'll explain what's changing. But a little context first. It was a 25-year-old employee of the bank and a 28-year-old former student at the school, both with grievances against their institutions, reportedly, both described as having mental health problems, reportedly, both nevertheless making recent legal purchases of the AR-15s they used in their attacks. Police say the Nashville shooter got off 152 shots from the semi-automatic gun, which fires more quickly than a regular handgun before police could intervene. Another difference between an AR-15 and non-semi-automatic, as NBC News explains it, AR-15s inflict much more damage to human tissue than the typical handgun. That's largely because of the speed at which projectiles leave the weapons. They're much faster out of the muzzle of an AR-15 or similar rifle and deliver a more devastating blow to bones and organs. So people who might survive being shot by something else don't survive being shot by AR-15s in many cases. And NBC says those projectiles are also more likely to break apart as they pass through the body, inflicting more damage. Now, the change is coming in Tennessee, where the Republican governor, Bill Lee, is now supporting more background checks relating to potential gun buyers' fitness to own a dangerous weapon. The change is also coming in the growth of the gun law reform movement that the governor felt the need to respond to, at least in that one red state. The movement is growing because of the shooting itself, and as many of you know, as a response to the expulsion of two young black lawmakers, Justin Pearson and Justin Jones, who protested on the Tennessee House floor after the shooting. They've both now been reinstated by officials in their local districts. They're going back to the House of Representatives in Tennessee. Here's Justin Pearson after his reinstatement yesterday.
We fight together.
Yeah.
And so the message for all the people in Nashville who decided to expel us. You can't expel hope.
Yeah.
You can't expel justice.
Yeah.
You can't expel our voice.
Yeah.
And you sure can't expel our fight.
Yeah.
We look forward to continuing to fight,
yeah,
continuing to advocate,
yeah,
until justice rolls down like water,
yeah,
and righteousness like an ever-flowing stream.
Yeah.
Let's get back to work.
Yeah.
Justin Pearson, now back in the House of Representatives in the Tennessee legislature, along with Justin Jones. Maybe you've heard the chant that had sprung up in some places, no Justins, no peace. Well, both Justins are back. We'll explain more now about what's changing in Tennessee and the national implications with a Nashville-based national expert on the topic. He is Dr. Jonathan Metzl, professor of sociology and psychiatry at Vanderbilt University in Nashville and director of the Center for Medicine, Health, and Society at the school, as well as research director for the gun violence prevention organization, the Safe Tennessee Project, and author of the book from 2019, Dying of Whiteness, How the Politics of Racial Resentment is Killing America's Heartland. Dr. Metzl, you were last here when your book came out. Don't know if you remember, you did a lot of book interviews. So thanks for coming on today when your city is at the center of the storm. Welcome back to WNYC.
It's great to be back. And of course, I remember our conversation very well.
Do these latest shootings in your state and the state next door fit into any of the patterns that you wrote about in your book?
Well, in the Dying of Whiteness, I was talking about people's attachment to guns and what that meant, even when the evidence was so clear that the moral effects were not just people thought that they were owning guns to protect people, to protect themselves, to protect their families. But what I was seeing was the breakdown of safety and health and all of these factors. And so I would say that there are many important trends that we're seeing in these shootings that I think link right back. Now, I want to be clear that in Dying of Whiteness, I talk mostly about gun suicide. I interview families who suffered from gun suicide. But I would say that the debates around guns that follow shootings, that follow death, this idea about do we have individual liberties or do we have a communal responsibility to others? What's the meaning of guns? Who gets to carry a gun in public? That was certainly something that I was tracking at, I think, a more subterranean level in southern Missouri and in Tennessee when I was doing my research. And now we're seeing that, that those debates really have blown out into the open much more than even they were before. And really, I think we're having a moment of reckoning in Tennessee about how can we protect Second Amendment rights on one hand and people and families and kids and workers on the other?
Yeah, and I'm glad you mentioned suicides because I think it's often worth saying whenever we talk about a mass shooting, which is a sensational incident, that much more gun violence, much more of the death from guns in the United States is in incidents that are one person at a time, including so many of them are suicides, right? So we shouldn't lose sight of the big picture, even though mass shootings, for obvious reasons, make the news more.
Right. Well, I mean, it's important, right? Mass shootings mobilize people. They garner attention. They seem just the pathological extremes of kind of they're really truly moments of reckoning. Like, how did we get here when this is happening to sanctuaries, people play safe. And so I think there are bigger conversations about society that happen after mass shootings that are very important. It's not just about numbers or statistics, but it is also important to note, as you say, that most gun death in the United States happens in silence. Upwards of two-thirds of gun death is gun suicide. When I was doing my research for my book, there were about 42,000-43,000 gun deaths a year in the United States, and about 26,000-27,000 of those were gun suicides. And those numbers have just gone up. We just had a record-breaking year. The data came out yesterday for suicides and gun suicides in 2021, 2022. And so most gun death is suicide, but for, I think, understandable reasons and maybe also conscious reasons, that doesn't get the same kind of attention that mass shootings do.
Right. And on the mass shootings, there's the group called the Gun Violence Project, which tracks mass shootings in the United States, defined as shootings in which at least four people are killed or injured. And it counts 145 mass shootings already this year in this country by that measure. So it's important to say out loud for the context that's very unusual in the wealthy industrialized world, isn't it?
I mean, there's really no correlate. If you just look at maps or graphs, we are on an island by ourselves. We have more mass shootings than we have calendar days. If you count every instance where four or more people are killed, it's also important to note that not all mass shootings, many happen with AR-15s, the one we hear about, but also many mass shootings happen with handguns and other kinds of weapons as well. And so we just have a steady drumbeat. And really, it's the most sensational. The bar is actually tragically quite high, but the most sensational shootings are the ones that we hear about. But there are so many happening that we don't hear about. And we also, of course, have more guns. We have more guns than people in our country. We have 40 million people in our country, and people are guessing about 450 million civilian-owned guns. And so the numbers are just off the charts in every regard.
And of course, the mass shootings have a psychological impact, a sociological impact, way beyond the people who are affected. They produce so much anxiety for everyone. You know, you could be a 7-year-old sitting in your second grade classroom, knowing that you have to do active shooter drills, which a generation ago people didn't have to do. The randomness of it freaks everyone out, from little kids to their parents and everyone else. People who are not close to getting into a dispute that might lead to an individual confrontation with a gun. And that's, I think, another reason that this drives a social response, a political response. So let's go into a little more detail on those few things you're probably cheering in Tennessee right now. The reinstatement of the two Justins to their seats in the state legislature, to be sure, plus the movement that they're part of, elevated and energized since the Nashville school shooting, and the expulsions energized it even more. And Republican Governor Bill Lee, generally pro-gun in his politics, signing an executive order now to keep the background check system updated within 3 days of a person's new criminal or mental health status change that would block them from a purchase, and asking the legislature to pass what he calls an order of protection law, like a red flag law, to keep guns out of the hands of people found through due process to be dangerous to themselves or others. Has it been an encouraging 2 days, in your opinion, in your state of Tennessee?
The bar is very low to start with. Pretty much any mammal can get a gun in Tennessee. We've overturned pretty much every gun law you can think of. And this session in particular, there were things coming down the pike. They wanted anyone 18 year old or older to be able to open carry an AK-47. There was a bill that was proposed to let police officers off duty who were drunk or high fire their guns. I mean, it got to the level of absurdity where people were just sitting around thinking, like, where else can we have guns? And so I'll just say the bar was quite low. And I say that because there was so much hopelessness, especially for people like me. I have an amazing colleague, Beth Roth, who helps run what is called the Safe Tennessee Project, and other people on the ground who've been working in red states for quite a long time. And we were beaten into the ground, honestly. There was just so much.
Can I give the listeners another example from Tennessee that I was reading and prepping for this conversation, and have you tell me whether this is actually the case? I think it's less than 2 years old, a law that allows people over 21 to carry a gun in public, concealed or even open carry, without a permit and without any training. Is that accurate?
Oh, no, that's very accurate. This was a very big deal in our state. There was a kind of slow drumbeat after Governor Lee was elected he allowed guns in people's trunks, guns in parks, guns on college campuses. There was a kind of drumbeat of increasingly permissive gun laws. And that 2021 bill, which he signed twice, he signed it at the Tennessee State House, and then he signed it at the Tennessee Beretta factory in front of gun executives, really opened the door for it. Just Tennessee became one of the top states, not just for gun rights, people would say gun ownership or what they call constitutional carry, that nobody should have any say. And so that 2021 bill was really important because, again, as you say, an adult could carry a handgun open or concealed without a permit and without any training whatsoever, and pushing that back to age 18 for people who'd been in the military. And so it really was a watershed moment, that 2021 bill, because it really opened the doors. And so I think that's important to note, that there are like kind of little poke in your eye kind of bills. And then there are really big ones like that 2021 move that really have a significant gun rights people. I have a lot of friends. I interview a lot of people. My research is interviewing gun owners who say this was great for their freedom and liberty and self-protection. And I can point on my side to public health data that shows that Tennessee went up even higher in the list of states where there's the most gun-related injury and death. Huh. And so it's really a push and pull. You had asked before about what happened over the last couple of days. And so I guess what I was, I would say that I'm very energized. I want to be very clear about that, that I think young people, students, are really getting out on this issue. After the mass shootings, people felt unsafe. And it was this mass shooting happened 2 miles away from Vanderbilt, where I worked. A lot of people know people at the Covenant School, or had their kids there, or knew people who were victims. And also, you could just hear it. I mean, I know a lot of places in the country have this, but when it's happening to you, when you hear the helicopters and the sirens. And at Vanderbilt, the sirens were getting quieter because they were going toward the shooting. And then they were getting louder because the victims were being brought back to Vanderbilt Hospital. And so it felt very personal. And there was really a rippling effect, as you say, a moment of terror in our city. And I do think that what happened next, I mean, there's so much learned helplessness about this issue, right? Things like this happen and then it goes nowhere. And really, the youth picked us up here. I mean, it was really incredible. Students, high school students, college students, Vanderbilt students, other students, and younger students too all came out to protest. I saw yesterday that middle schoolers marched to Governor Lee's residence to deliver letters about keeping us safe. And so the pressure after this shooting, I think, was quite considerable in a way that I don't think red state politicians have really felt, that kind of uniform pressure. And I don't know. I as I was watching it, I thought there's no way he can do nothing. And so I think what happened is an important first step. But as always, the devil is in the details. What will happen? Will those laws go into effect? It's also important to note that we had a Supreme Court case, the Bruin case, last summer, that really opened the door to challenge any kind of gun reform. And so is what he did constitutional? I think that'll be the pushback on it. But I would say the very fact that he's saying he'll talk to his caucus about this, I think is a major step. I don't want to minimize that. And I also want to just give all the thanks in the world to the young people who made this happen.
Yeah. So it's progress to hear someone like Governor Bill Lee of Tennessee say these few simple words, which I'm about to play, which probably sound like common sense to most people listening, but here's the governor.
A person that has shown that they are a real threat to themselves or to others, that person, that individual, should not have access to firearms.
Well, yeah, but I also read that Governor Lee won't call his proposal for an order of protection law, that's what he calls it, a red flag law, as it's usually known, because Republicans are against red flag laws. Do you know what he's really proposing, and if it's different from what you would call a red flag law?
Right. I don't mean to like complicate every answer, but this is just very complicated space. So I will say that there is a lot of debate about what to call these. There's also a pushback on the left to calling these red flag laws, because people feel like it makes people with mental illness look like ticking time bombs or red flags. And so the debate about what to call them, now the left, people on the left like me, had proposed, you know, ERPOs or extreme risk protection orders, all this kind of clunky verbiage. And So I think I don't really care what we call it, honestly, and I don't care what he calls it. I think the important thing to note about these kind of laws are two things. First of all, it's incredible to note, especially in red states, what people have to go through if they see a relative spiraling, not just toward violence toward others, but toward violence toward themselves. They actually would have to get their relative committed, and then that commitment would have to get up to an involuntary hospitalization, and then they'd have to meet with this crazy board to, you know, take away their gun laws. Like, it was hardly anybody, and families, I think, felt very, very helpless about this. I think that's the important point, that when you saw somebody spiraling, a relative probably knows their relative better than a police person or an average judge or somebody who's going to see them, even a psychiatrist, because they see that person every day. And so there were no avenues really to say, hey, man, my relative is looking really bad now and we need a little bit of help. And that actually happened in both of the shootings, Kentucky and Tennessee, where the relatives needed some help. And so what this is just doing is saying, here's a process with which when somebody reaches out and says, we need some help, it's not going to involve involuntary commitment. It's not going to involve that person losing their Second Amendment rights. Instead, there's a process through which that there'll be a temporary restriction. That person will maybe lose access to guns for 30 days or 60 days or 6 months or something like that. But there's a process of a temporary removal of firearms for somebody who has shown a kind of spiraling behavior. And so it's really very, very basic. And as you say, it seems like common sense, right? And I think initially these red flag laws were seen as compromise positions between people who care a lot about Second Amendment rights and people who just wanted to give families something to do that they could get kind of some help. But we'll see how it plays out.
By the way, is that like safety theater, or do red flag laws, so-called, actually work? I heard Connecticut Senator Chris Murphy, who, you know, is a leading advocate for gun law reform, say on TV this morning that after the Parkland shooting in Florida, they passed a red flag law that's prevented around 6,000 gun sales. And I'm just curious if you've looked at Florida or any other state and, as a researcher, have a judgment of if red flag laws are actually preventing actual deaths and injuries.
Well, as a teaser, my next book will address this exact question. It comes out in January. So I will say, hopefully we'll be back and talk about that.
Make this your earliest possible book interview invitation.
You got it. But I will say that I think the question is, how do you judge progress? I think that there was such frustration on the side of people pushing for gun safety. It was kind of like, what can we do that will work, that will bring together both sides of this contentious debate? And so there have been studies of, I'm going to use the shorthand red flag laws. That's just kind of what I do, but everybody calls them different things. But I will say that the early studies of red flag laws showed maybe a 15% reduction in, and this was before they were widely known. People didn't know they were available. They stopped shootings, but they also stopped suicides. I think that's the big thing, is that the early data showed that they were effective. When somebody saw their relative spiraling towards suicide, they also had, so it wasn't just about stopping mass shootings. I think that's what falls out of the conversation a lot of times. And so I don't know. I mean, a place like Tennessee, again, you can buy a gun at a gun show. You can buy a gun, your neighbor can buy you a gun. There's 10,000 guns everywhere. And so it's not like any one policy is going to be like the magic elixir that's going to stop this. But I will say that you're just giving families something to do. And I would be curious to know, what the data would be in a place where red flag laws are really, and not just enforce is the wrong word. People know that that's a resource. But also in a red state, like if Tennessee does go down this path, what will the effect be? And I'd be curious to see that. But I certainly think that the early data shows maybe a 10-15% reduction. But again, I would take that with a grain of salt, because a lot of people don't know that that's an option.
Dr. Metzl, I know you got to run. Thanks for your complexity of thought on this, for your passion on this. And keep a late morning appointment open in your calendar for when that next book comes out, okay?
You got it. Thanks so much.
Brian Lehrer, a Daily Politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at WNYC.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.